Today I have a special guest, Kyla Yu. She's the author of Fetishized, A Reckoning with Yellow Fever, Feminism, and Beauty. Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast, Kyla.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, we had just talked about me picking up this book and agreeing to this idea of ABGs and the 90s and all of these things that the Asian American experience you write about. I grew up in this period. You write a lot about the experiences that I went through. I thought I knew what went on, and I thought I had a really good grasp of processing those years. But in actuality, it's one of those things, the deeper you dig into a subject matter, the less you actually know. So I look forward to really getting into these topics today.
Yeah, it's crazy. As I've been talking about this topic, which I have deeply researched, I'm still like going down these rabbit holes of like somebody told me the other day that Okinawan's military base is still continuing to kind of objectify the local women. And I found out just this June 2025, a Marine or like a military, American military guy was convicted of rape of Okinawan women like last month. So things are still happening that we don't even hear about.
I was 17 when I spent a year in Okinawa as a Marine.
Oh, okay. Oh, wait, fascinating. So you had firsthand. Oh my God, I would love to actually talk to you about that because you observed this, right?
And whatever you're writing in these chapters is like mind-blowing because I'm like, this is, I'm the male counterpart of what you experienced. And I actually was working on a memoir for the last 5 years, but from the other side, not from the white fetish side, but from the male Asian emasculated side, right?
Yeah.
So you write about all these things and I'm like, obviously my piece would be structured very differently, but I'm like this, that's why I was so looking forward to this interview today. I'm very excited to get into this stuff. And, you know, you talk about it from a very different, you know, but let's get to this idea, of when we think about embarking on a journey like this, there's a lot of work that goes into it. What inspired you to finally write something like this?
It was so accidental. I mean, I had finished my career in entertainment and I had segued into a travel writer. And then I was very happily working as a travel writer. And then the pandemic hit. So all my gigs and all my work was canceled. Social media has been such an important part of my career all through the beginning of when social media started. But I never had time to learn TikTok, and I really wanted to because I knew that there was like, you know, even as a writer, it really benefits your work and like gets you taken more seriously if you have a following. So I ended up trying to learn TikTok during the pandemic, and I spent an entire year just posting 5 videos a day, trying everything.
Wow.
Food content, recipe content, travel content, sobriety content. And none of it really hit until I started posting about the 2000s Asian American experience. And, you know, nobody was really posting about that. And I was an expert during that, you know, like I was just very present during that time. So I started doing that for a year and was really reflecting back on my career because I was posting about it. And then the Atlanta spa shootings happened. So then, you know, the whole Asian community was reflecting back on how the media was making us invisible again by saying it was not racially or sexually motivated when every Asian women knew it to be both, like just in our core. And then I started to reflect back on how I kind of courted fetishization and objectification when I was younger. And that ultimately inspired an article that like eventually inspired the book. But yeah, I never had any intention of writing a memoir.
One of the biggest questions that you pose, is it a fetish or is it a preference? Oh my God. You know, this is something that I think about a lot because I think a lot of Asian men are into white women as an ultimate goal, right? Mm. Now, but when I'm reading your book, it's obviously a really a good breakdown of the historical side of the reverse of white men fetishizing Asian women. And you go through meticulous detail, the research, you bring in academics, there's so much good footnotes, and a lot of pop content too, which is Miss Saigon and Memoirs of a Geisha, all of these IPs that we never really thought about up until
that. I loved,
we all love it. We all think that, oh my God, there's representation.
There's
out there.
Asians, like whatever, we'll take it. Yeah.
Yes. You get into all of these things. So, you know, I think when I thought about the thumbnail of this episode, I thought fetish or preference. That's basically how I think about our conversation today. But let's lead off on that. Let's make that. Can you kind of guide me through that distinction of when you think things are a fetish or when you think they're a preference?
Yeah, and I want to start off by saying, because a lot of individual men get mad when I post videos about fetishization, and I'm not policing individual choices. My problem is with the power structure, which I believe the patriarchy is harmful to both men and women. So, and also, it is very nuanced, like preference or fetish. Like, I can't say blanket statement, you have a fetish. You know what I mean? Like, you know inside whether you do. It's an individual, decision. But one way to tell is, like, are you objectifying women, treating them as disposable, having very specific expectations of their behavior, and just going through them, Like, a very good example is the character from White Lotus, who basically says he, like, goes to find himself by going to Thailand and sleeping with as many Asian women as possible. That's, like, literally using them as a tool. So I would say most men probably don't fall under that. It's, like, probably a really vocal minority that are these Asian fetishes. I'll give another example. There's this viral video of this like 60-year-old white man that went viral on TikTok, and he was giving advice to passport bros or whatever. And he was like, you can go to Asia and, like, get this fine ass woman and, like, much hotter than you could get here. And she's going to leave you inevitably in 3 or 4 years, but no worries, you'll get another one. So that's, like, kind of an illustration of it.
Yeah, that's very clear. But I also have family in the South and in the East Coast that, there's not a lot of Asian men around, so they date white men. And I hang out with them, and there are there's love, a deep love. And I think that there's a respect for my family. Otherwise, I would speak up. But there's also this blind sort of contextually when they make fun of Asian people, like the white guys. And that is when it gets to be a little bit, temperature rises inside of me, but I have to calm it down a little bit.
Well, it's very sad too, because there are plenty of white and Asian female couples that are just true love. But, like, I have an example of a married friend that I have, a white guy. He's married to an Asian woman. First Asian woman he ever dated, he just fell in love with her. But he gets these comments about Asian fetishism, and he's like, I've never even dated an Asian before. Like, this. So it's like unfortunate that, like, just a good man's going to get put under this umbrella. Yeah.
Yeah. And that definitely happens. You see that with a good white man being with a really wonderful, Vietnamese or Asian, woman, and it works out. It's fine. It checks out. That distinction, however, still lingers, I think, in our consciousness. And there's history to unpack. Yes. And I think that one of the big questions that I wanted to know after understanding the difference between fetish and preference, and you break it down very well. You just summarized it right now, but you break it down really well in your book. which I think audience members, we all have to pick up. It's a really good read.
Thanks.
And going back to this idea, the lines are so blurred in terms of this way of looking at it. And people who are quote unquote anti-woke could just say, look, we just like Asian women. What's the big deal? Like, why do we have to think so deeply about that? And that's the question I want to pose to you. It's like, why do people like you and I care about this so much that we have to put it on a podcast? I have my reasons, but I would love to hear, why is it so important that we talk about this?
Well, it's the same thing as saying, like, when somebody who's not of color says, I don't see color. It's because you don't have to, you know? Like, I see color every day. That's my life. So it's not like I'm choosing to look at color. Like, that's something I have to consider since I was a little kid. And everyone should, like, question their choices. Like, you shouldn't be evaluating yourself. I've evaluated, like, I've gotten cosmetic surgeries. Like, what was the reason? Like, I don't regret some of them, but would I have made those choices under different influences? Like, probably, but I've analyzed these choices and I'm aware, you know.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Yeah, and the amount of sort of available context for the everyday person is not in your face. It's not readily available. You have to, again, like what you said, you have to, like, be forced to live in this idea of color to understand, like, where you're coming from. But when you're looking at it from, you know, from a distance, you don't really see it. You don't really see the pain that these people are going through. You don't really get to experience the feelings and the emotions that are happening. But then again, it's almost like when you write about the pain, and I often think about, like, the pain of being Vietnamese and growing up Vietnamese, but a lot of my counterparts in maybe Mississippi or, you know, Tennessee, who are Vietnamese or Asian American, they don't go through this. They don't feel this. So it is like, are we so far on, and I don't consider us woke, but aware. Are we so aware that it impedes on our ability to, like, date a white woman for me at this point, you know?
I don't think so. I feel like you can see each person as a multifaceted individual. So, for example, I do, if I'm dating a non-Asian, I do ask, like, what was your ethnicity? And it's unfortunate that every Asian woman needs to ask that. And it doesn't necessarily matter to everyone, but I don't want to be the fourth Asian woman you dated in a row. That's weird to me. It's just like if, like, you looked at all my exes and they were, like, all Australian and exactly the same or something, that would be weird. But yeah, obviously I don't have to ask an Asian guy that question because it's just different. Like, Asian guys can't fetishize. There's not the colonial history. Not that I'm going to take Asian men off the hook, because there's a history in East Asia and Southeast Asian countries of oppression of women there. But Asian American men aren't doing that.
Yeah, they're not. But they're doing fetish in a different way. They're fetishizing white women in a very different way. And that is not talked about much, but
it's not talked about much, and the policing of Asian women dating white men is, like, vicious. Like, they will launch coordinated attacks against famous Asian women who have white lovers or boyfriends or husbands, which is, like, problematic, because it's also, like, I don't think Asian women should ever denigrate Asian men in their choices. Like if they decide to date white, they don't need to say like, oh, I don't like to date Asian men because they look like my brother or whatever they like to say. I don't believe they should say that. But also Asian women don't owe their bodies to anyone. And we're perfectly free to choose to date whoever we want.
Yeah, it's 100%. There is an issue, I think, for the most part, and I am guilty of this. I think that when Asian women or any woman date Asian men, I think probably Asian men dating Asian women, there's an expectation that the old country's tradition, no matter how removed you are, I was born in America in the first wave of Vietnamese coming. No matter how removed you are, there's still some bullshit that's lodged in your brain about traditional roles. No matter how liberal and progressive you are like me, it's still in there. And if we're not doing our work to expunge this, to really get it off of our mental record, it sits there. And I think that's why it's a lot easier for Asian women to date outside of their race.
Yeah, and it is also sometimes internalized racism, which sounds so horrible, but it's not. It's just like you grow up in a country where the white man is the hero of every movie and like the quarterback in every like teen thing. And that's just like, and then conversely, Asian men while I was growing up was like in Revenge of the Nerds or something, or in like 16 Candles. So of course you're so influenced by this. And now you can see the flip side, which is that K-pop is out and now there's a bunch of white women in love with Korean men because it's just representation, like whatever the media is selling us.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, isn't it? To see, I mean, I'm definitely affected and I'm grateful for what BTS has done for my life.
Yeah.
The shift is mind blowing, you know, especially if you're on these dating apps. I remember being on dating apps way before I was married, and the difficulty when the first dating apps like Match.com was out, it was very difficult to kind of figure this out. It was all about the writing and you had to really, but today, as an Asian man on the dating apps, it's a much easier process. But you can also see the profiles of these white women.
Oh,
that they
are
love.
They liking anime or something like K-pop?
Kind of. Yes, they're liking anime. There's all this K-pop. There's all these K-dramas. You can see them all listed. It is just phenomenal to see. And the pictures they're taking at like anime conventions. And
oh my God. So like, they're just kind of like the white men. Yeah, too. But there's no colonialist background of white women. Yeah, in that way.
It's a fascinating time that we live in. But I think it's important to really think about and talk about the things that you talk about. One thing I wanted to talk about was agency. This idea that women, Kimberly K. Huang, somebody you quoted in the book, has spoken about this. And I think a little bit is controversial. The idea, and it shouldn't be controversial, it should be very, like, women should have agency. They should have a decision. The ability to, if they want to be an import model, if they want to do porn, if they want to do things that, whatever they want, they should have governance over their own physical or mental existence, right? But we are so locked in, I think, today in conservative values that we are struggling to figure out how much do we let the individual woman handle their decisions and how much does the state or the rest of the white man population control this?
Yeah, I think they should have no say. But also like as in I never also want to judge a woman for making choices to be a sex worker or like whatever, get into pornography or even just be a pinup model or even just be a sexy girl on Instagram. The only problem is that whenever you question a 20-year-old about these choices, they're going to say, I'm empowered. I said that. But now, decades later, I realized I was just kind of playing into the patriarchy, like almost getting tricked by it. So, and I don't want a blanket statement that either, because somebody might participate in these careers and come out very empowered. Like for me, it wasn't a healthy choice and it wasn't an authentic choice personally.
But how do I have a daughter? She's eight. How do like I'm reading it the whole your book the whole time and I'm like, I'm flip-flopping. I'm like, okay, empowered, give her this information. No. I have to guide this quietly. I'm trying to navigate through raising my daughter to this wild world that we're living in. And I think that one false step, one false move can really, you know, put her in a hurtful situation that she might not recover from.
I kind of have like not an easy solution to this, but like I just felt very unloved from a very young age. And my parents loved me unconditionally, by the way, but Asian parents do not, of that generation, did not show love in any kind of traditional way. I just felt unloved because I was like always saying, oh, you're not good enough. And like this, you know, comparing you to this and that. Or my parents never told me I love you until like maybe recently. I feel like if a young woman just is told she's loved and beautiful by her father and she feels love, that would not completely make her, like, I think I would have made different choices if I just felt loved.
You wrote about that in the chapter Daddy. And I was reading that you were, I think, trying to give him a hug or something like that. Or there was something, I think, with your father, and he pushed you away and he said that's inappropriate or something, or gave you that signal that it's inappropriate. From that point of reading that, for me, I changed the way I deal with my daughter. And I could see literally the reaction that she has towards me from the day I made the decision that if she's running up to me and I might be busy, I'm editing or I'm doing work, I have to take time and be present and give her a big hug and kiss her and tell her I love you and you mean so much to me. And that's what I've been doing. And I could see her just coming over at my workstation and hugging me and not even needing that. But like, I think the presence, the mindfulness of reading that passage for me changed the way I am dealing with my daughter.
Oh, wow. I love that. Yeah. Little girls should just feel loved and cherished and beautiful. And then after that, I think they make healthier choices from that place.
As Kid Rock says, your only job as a dad, keep her off the pole. Have you heard of that?
No. It's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I always heard that way before I had kids and a daughter, but that is not instructive enough.
Yeah. Like how do I do it?
The way to do it is what you're saying. It's not a magic bullet, but it definitely helps guide what is it, girl dads? Yeah, help. I'm a girl
dad.
Yeah,
I mean, daddy issues is like a real term that exists, right? For women searching for validation they didn't get from their father. And it might be from toxic men. It might be how I did it for male gaze. It's a real thing.
And do you feel today that after writing the book, do you feel, and probably therapy and all of that, do you feel like that experience of going through all of that, you're free from it. You're outside of the discomfort now of it.
Well, I think I'll be healing it from it for the rest of my life.
Oh wow!
But I also feel like I have like an exponential amount of self-love as compared to then, and I think that's a lifetime practice for everybody. There's an infinite amount of love that you can give to yourself, and I think we need to be taught that. We can also love ourselves. It's just not something we're taught as human beings. And we're always searching for love from our parents or whatever. And that's great. And we should be getting that. But we also need to learn to love ourselves.
Yeah. And that's hard. I think as Asian people, that's hard. The children of my mother is Taiwanese as well, and you're Taiwanese. And it's a culture that's very different from Vietnamese, I think. And I'm just generalizing here. It's just different. The communication is far less than on the Vietnamese side, and on the Vietnamese side, it's already less. It's like, yeah. You know, even people. We do not like to talk to our kids, you know. It's uncomfortable. It's a very uncomfortable place, but it produces this detached sense of the kid. They're not anchored to anything that's sort of stable. And I think that you know, going forward, as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking, well, what is the way out if we're here now, right? We're like in our 40s and, you know, some of us like me crossing into our 50s soon. What kind of things do we kind of need to kind of think about in terms of our wellness?
Well, I'm reading this book that is changing my life now. And I read a lot of these self-help books, but like it's called Love Yourself Like Your Life Depends on It. And it's just about building a mental loop that automatically says, I love myself. And that's like, whenever something bad happens, when you have any fear, that's the automatic thought you have. And it trains you to think that way. And slowly you begin to see your life change into someone who like unconditionally loves themselves. So I would recommend that book. But yeah, you know, like therapy, I think, is beneficial to everybody, and reflecting back on your life's choices and patterns, which I ended up doing in recovery, but I think that's valuable for everyone.
But when the moments are so fun and you're going through all of this, and this is maybe addressed to the young audience, but this question is for the young audiences who are going through raves right now, you know, partying and, you know, going to Vegas and living it up. But there's consequences on that back end, right? You know, what do we say to the young folks that are kind of going through this detached feeling with their parents, and they're thinking that they're being empowered by, you know, doing certain things that they probably wouldn't have the freedom to do in the old country?
Well, it's hard because, you know, as somebody in their 20s, they should get to have fun and go wild and make mistakes and live their life. There's some part of that. I think like I personally took it too far, but there's a healthy amount of that that is part of just growing up. But I think a lot of it has to do with just conversations, like having safe people that you can talk freely about all your fears and your like worst secrets. I didn't have that. But I think if I had somebody I trusted, a safe space, and a lot of us aren't willing to have these conversations in front of our friends because we want to look a certain way, you know, don't want them to know you're feeling shame about this or that. But I think the conversations help us process a lot of these emotions that are stuck, and you keep stuffing these emotions underneath drugs and like escapism. So yeah, I think it's conversations.
You know, I'm reading your book and I'm like, oh my God, you've gone through these dopamine hits throughout your entire life up until you probably got into recovery and all that. And I'm thinking those are very fun and happy moments. But at the same time, I'm like, what kind of fun or happy moments are you experiencing today with all of that information and data and dopamine experience? What at this point in your life makes you happy and present and content?
I think it really becomes down to the simple things. Like gratitude is also an important practice, I think. Like I've done the whole gratitude lists and all of those, like daily gratitude lists, where you like send it to a group of friends and everybody sends their list. I think that's a helpful practice. But like, I just love simple things like eating a delicious meal or like traveling to a tropical destination or getting underwater or like playing with my cats and being present, you know? You have to be able to enjoy the simple things because the dopamine hits aren't like happening five times a day or even monthly, you know?
Yeah, and I asked that because your book is packed with adventure, but not in a oh my God, I had all this fun and look at me writing style. That's not what I'm talking about. You walk us through a lot of dark moments, and you break down a lot of this stuff. But at the same time, it, you know, because I lived through those years, and I remember how fun it was to. Did you write about the green triangles?
The first time I did ecstasy felt like love. Like it felt like everything I was missing. I was pure and whole, and it felt like God. I'd never had a connection with God, but like that's what it felt like. And I wanted more of it.
I would do like 12 a night. It was crazy.
Wait, does that even work anymore? It only like works like even after like the second one, the third one doesn't do anything. Nope.
There's a law of diminishing returns. After two.
It's very disappointing, I would say.
But I think at the time, I didn't know about it, and I didn't smoke weed, but weed would have done the trick, right? Like it would have just like brought it. And I like to talk about this topic of drugs because. I just theorize, there's no data in my brain or that I've read. Anecdotally, I feel like when the gangs of Orange County and the 626 was raging in the mid-90s, but it all died down. And I'm sure there was like-
Yeah, are they still there?
No.
Really? I just wasn't hanging around them anymore.
My theory is when ecstasy came out, all the gang members were hugging it out. You see it?
I remember that. I remember seeing the guys and the wife beaters like all being nice to everybody. Yeah.
Totally. You're like, wait a minute. These are gangsters and they were like all hanging out and all tatted up at the
raves. That's hilarious. Yeah. They were there. Yeah. They were very present and they were very happy.
They were very happy. They were very, you know, everything just kind of like died down and kind of the gangs went away. And maybe I think there was police coordination as well that jumped in and really helped out.
Yeah, I honestly don't regret my time with ecstasy. I had pretty pure fun with that. It was the only problem was that it was a gateway into like worse drugs. But that period when I first raved for the first year, like I actually really enjoyed that time.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask you about the ABG scene. That's always a fun thing to talk about because it's a snapshot of the Vietnamese culture. And I know you're not Vietnamese, but you lived around that time. And for a lot of us that don't know, it's Asian baby girls is what the reference refers to. But I want to hear from your experience, what that was like living through those times with, and you brought up a really good point in the book. You said that it's attributed to like Korean, Chinese, Japanese look, but really it's the Laotian, Cambodians, Vietnamese, AKA the jungle Asians. You know, I hate to use that word, but I've been called that and I can use that word because I'm Vietnamese, but you kind of make a reference to that. I want to hear that kind of breakdown.
Well, they didn't even originate it. They appropriated it kind of from cholas. Like that whole look was by adjacent to like the Mexican gangs. But the ABG term only came up, I think, in the last 10 years or more. We didn't know we were ABGs at the time. But when I was first introduced to it, I was like probably 15. I was hanging around all white people and then I met this cool ass Korean girl who like really pretended to be gangster and she had all these watching friends, but she had that look, the straight blonde hair with a little bit of like blow dried up here and super skinny eyeliner and the dark lips with a dark brown lipstick on the outside. But yeah, you can see that the cholas at our school had that very same look, but we didn't like make that connection really at the time. But yeah, a lot of the watching gangsters were, I guess, affiliated with or rivals against the Asian boys. So I feel like that's maybe how it somehow filtered to the East Asians eventually. But then after that, like the import models really popularized that look. Unconsciously, I don't think anybody was like recognizing that during the time.
It elevated that look. Elevated the ABG look.
Yeah, it just made it a little more mainstreamed, I guess.
And when I think about the ABG look, I think it's more baggy jeans, baggy t-shirts a bit. Yeah. But when you think about the kind of the transference over to the import models, it's more like more skin, mm-hmm. And just it shows more of the body that we're talking with. And it's ironic that the term ABG evolved recently as a description to the girls in that era. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I don't know how that came about, like who decided. I mean, it said that it originated in the subtle Asian traits group, but nobody knows for sure where the term came from and why it like covered this very specific period of time.
Yeah.
But now it's like, it's kind of similar to Valley Girls, right? It's a little bit of a dig because Valley Girls are ditzy and like dumb blondes. And then Asian baby girls are kind of like, oh, they're like sexy, maybe loose. They do drugs. They like to go raving and they like to date guys with hot cars and like drink boba and smoke jewels.
You make me think of the Instagram post memes of the ABG starter kit.
Yes. Yeah.
You just mentioned all that. It's crazy to think that when I think back to import models or even just pinup models of the 50s of Coca-Cola pinup models, there's this idea that there's a person inside of every one of those. There's a thinking woman inside of it. And you wrote in the book, over the course of my career, I wondered if my fans, and I'm just paraphrasing at this point, know that I had dreams, basically, right? Like there's a person who has dreams. But what I wanted to find out is, do we as a public, the public, have an obligation to care about your dreams? Or should we think about your dreams? Because your choice, and honestly, the privilege of being that beautiful is not sort of, it's not happening in my awareness, right? As a young man or as the public who's gawking at you. Where does that responsibility, is there a line in the sand? Like what should we think as young men or whoever looking up at the model?
Well, I don't think they have any obligation to do so, but I would just say in comparison, when somebody is in love with a movie star, usually they want to know everything about them. Like, oh, what books do they like to read? Blah, blah, blah. But there's just not that same desire by a man who's a fan of a woman, because it's purely aesthetic usually. And that's not necessarily their fault, because I marketed myself that way, right? But it's different from somebody who's a fan of like a musician.
Yeah, that makes sense. But at the same time, I want to, you know, address that there's an exchange perhaps. And moving forward into time and as we are becoming all more aware of breaking maybe that fourth wall, that there's a person on the other side, you know, how do we as the public, am I overthinking this? You know, I think about it. It's like, well, I'm there to enjoy what I'm seeing because the performer has put on this performance. But yeah, maybe she, well, I now know that you have these dreams of being seen or... But there's a trade-off, you know, whether it's time or money or dignity that we're exchanging here for the work and for the performance. And it's something that tears me up because I want my daughter to one day be a performer. And, you know, I'm torn about like where does that corner, that line is drawn in the sand?
Well, I think it's a very different time because it's such a parasocial, you know, where there's a lot of parasocial relationships between the audience and the performers, because Back then, it was much more separated. There wasn't as much communication. Mm. But now with social media platforms, everyone can like share their points of views and like get really deep and granular about like their hopes and dreams. And it may be up to the performer to be sharing this information. You know, I might not have shared very much because I was like trying to promote something very specific.
I have a few more questions, but where can we find the book and when can we find the book?
So the book is out on August 19th and you can find it anywhere at all bookstores, but support your independent bookstores. And also I'll be doing a signing at the Barnes and Noble's The Grove at August 19th with, it was Margaret Cho, but she couldn't make it anymore because of her filming schedule. And it's now going to be AJ and Alyssa Raphael, who are some super talented old school YouTuber musicians. So I'm super excited about that discussion.
Oh, awesome. And I love The Grove. That's an amazing place.
Yeah.
You bring up such cherished, like a snapshot in time for me, Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses. And
yeah, so good.
Mm-hmm. And Pam Anderson.
Yeah.
Yeah. And today we see Pam in a completely different light. And her, you know, I don't know if it's like actually hooking up with Liam Neeson or I don't know what that deal is, but
I hope so. I love that. Yeah. I hope they're together.
Yeah. Yeah. But this idea of, you know, this bombshell, this vixen, like Pam Anderson, turning it around and just going completely natural. I am here for it and I love it.
Yes,
but at the same time, it's also a privilege that she can do that because
she's beautiful. Yeah. But I love what I'm seeing. Like the Pamela Anderson thing makes me deeply happy because we destroyed her in the 2000s. She had a very precious tape with her love of her life stolen. And basically the male lawyers or whatever that are arguing against her said, you're in Playboy, so what's the problem? You know, like them having intercourse and everybody getting to watch it for free. And they won, you know, on that. And it destroyed her career. She never came back from it. So I'm so excited to see that now she's getting like a renaissance basically.
Yeah. What a bold and courageous woman to go out in public. And I mean, I shouldn't even be calling her bold and courageous, right? It's just, it goes back to agency, but at the same time, there's a lot of strength in Pamela Anderson in going out without makeup and looking very natural. And it doesn't seem like she's getting more work done. I think she's just kind of put the brakes on all of that. You know, I don't know what to call it. Is it admirable, more respectable? Because this idea of agency still needs to play its part.
It's very courageous. Like I've done a lot of self-work and I'm not walking around, you know, to a big event without makeup on, you know, I recognize the male gaze and the patriarchy, but there is like, women were taught like put on a fresh coat of lipstick and you can like take on the world. So I still fall under those learnings that I haven't unraveled completely. So I think what she's doing is incredibly courageous and I hope it inspires more of it.
There's parallels for that, I think, from women's boldness and courage to do that to actually being a real Asian American and taking and stripping down the pretensions that we have to carry to be white adjacent. Choices we make in art, the choices we make as in our personal lives, being around white people, being able to eat chicken feet and being loud about that in our post or whatever, right? Like there are things that we don't dare do because we don't want to be so naked around our white friends. And I think that that's why this topic is such a beautiful thing to me because it takes a lot of courage to, I think just as a human being, to strip down and bear it all?
Yeah, if we could all do that, first of all, there would be so much more compassion and understanding. I just feel like if we could just take time to like hear each other's stories and be, it's just not always safe to tell your story. That's a problem, you know, like you tell everybody to be honest. It's not necessarily safe or to say your story on a, I have a alligator thick skin, so I'm okay with all the criticism that for sure will be coming, but not everybody had to go through what I did to have that. So I think maybe just like in your safe circles, having places that you're safe to be yourself authentically and share.
Yeah, you definitely put it all out there. And I was just blown away by what you wrote and the rawness of feeling, of expressing the feelings that you had. And I hope that this is a sort of a beacon to Asian Americans and women, no matter what color, what stripe or anything you come from.
Yeah, I just, you know, I am a feminist, which isn't like maybe a popular thing to say these days because there's been such a negative connotation, but it does not take anything away from men for me to be a feminist. There's like this idea that if like we get powers, we have to take it away from men. Like we should be working together and men should want equality for themselves and for us. I think it's beneficial to all of society.
I have a question that happened to me recently, and it seems to be a recurring theme every now and then. This idea back in the day, like let's just say old country in Italy, when women walk by, beautiful women walk by, the guys would whistle, the guys would like say things, and it's just this playful banter between men and women on the streets, bordering harassment. Let's call it what it is. And now, if we are amongst a group of guy friends, two or three of us, and we're making comments, and one guy says, hey, like, I expect better of you. But at what point does this gawking, this natural insistence on commenting on how hot a woman or a man is, you know, where do we draw the line? You know, if the woman is not hearing it or if she's hearing it, that bravado that comes from men, I think some women do miss it, but then some really aware men are also turned off by other guys that are doing that in their crew. So as somebody who's really did a lot of introspection about the male gaze and all this, where do you stand on all of this sort of raw energy that's coming out from men today?
See, I don't know if there's an easy answer to that. I don't think there's anything wrong with appreciating beauty, but usually the men aren't saying like, oh, wow, she is so beautiful. It's usually like very sexually tinged, right? And the idea is like, oh, I want to fuck her. I think there's maybe the distinction. There's a way to admire with respect, and that should still be allowed. And I think
let me stop you right there. So if you're in a, and I'm just putting it out there, if you're in a group of guys and the guys are like, oh, God would love to fuck her, right? There's some reality there that is raw. You know, Ocean Vuong, a writer in the Vietnamese diaspora, he writes and talks about this idea that American men talks about the idea of sex in very militaristic, violent ways. Let's smash that. Let's hit that. Did you pound, fucking pound that, right?
Yes, yeah.
I get that. That's where I would be like, okay. But if I'm, and I'm not advocating this, I'm just really questioning this idea of like, if I'm standing with my friends, I'm like, man, I would love to fuck her, right? That is something that is sexually tinged and it's full of dynamite, but it's also the truth of like my visceral feeling that I have for that woman. And I can say it with respect. I'm like, hey guys, respectfully. So where do we draw the line with our communication anymore?
I don't know the answer to that. I think you should be able to be honest, and maybe you have that conversation with your guys and don't let the woman hear it, because that can be jarring and objectifying. But yeah, I don't know an easy answer to that.
And you know, people say it all the time. When women objectify us, bring it on.
Yeah, well, men love it, because women generally don't say like, oh, I want to fuck that guy. They're like, oh, he's like a really hot or something, but they're not thinking of sex immediately. And it's very hard for me to speak on this because I don't think like a man. I don't think of sex constantly. You know, like I have no understanding of how men are like, kind of sex is driving a lot of decisions, so I'm told. If there's a way for you to express yourself and it's not like, see, it is kind of objectifying a woman if you're saying like, oh, I just want to fuck her, you know? I don't know the answer to that,
right?
Honestly.
But that's
yeah.
all you have to go off of, right? As a man, you're so visual. Everything's visual. Oh, I'd love to
like,
get
can
to know
you just
her.
Say, oh, she's really hot, and not need to say, oh,
yes,
I want to fuck her?
Yes, yeah. You can. You definitely can. You should keep it at that. Because when I think about somebody saying that about my daughter, that's when, you know, that's when the problem, you know, that's a problem. But at the same time, I don't want to discount what men have felt and communicated with each other for hundreds of years. You know, I mean, this has gone on, and maybe the time to evolve is now. And that's why we're talking about this.
Do men only think this way because society has socialized them and expectations for them to be this way? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of truth in that, because there are classy men that don't do that, that don't engage in that behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's like almost like guys want to be like one of the boys, so they might amp that up just to be cool, you know, because patriarchy.
Yeah. Kyla, it was so fun talking about your book today, Fetishize. I want to remind the audience, comes out August 19th. And you can get them on all the virtual online bookstores. But please, if you can, neighborhood mom and pop bookstores to pick up the book. You have any last closing things to say?
No. Just had a great conversation. I think we really dug into a lot of things. So I just hope that everybody can openly speak and listen to different sides, you know, without judging, because we're at this point so quick and polarized to not even want to listen or discuss to people with different opinions. This is for liberals too. Like, we need to be more open-minded.
Yes, we do. Kyla, thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Thank you
for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.